Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. You can visit our website at technicallylegal.org. There we have a bunch of blog postings and related news about the internet and technology and the way that the law impacts it. So with me today are my two fellow panelists.
Dominic Grabier.
And Benjamin Snitkoff.
And I'm David O'Brien, and I'll be hosting the show for this week. So first, to start off, we have some quick administrative stuff that we should probably mention. We have come up with a tentative launch date, hopefully sometime in the next week. And at that point forward, you should be seeing a lot more posts on the site, and hopefully we'll be covering a lot more news. So we can start to just jump right on into it. We have a bunch of interesting stories for this week. Certainly, we are going to dive into the always murky area of patent law and the way that that might apply to software. And we have another story related to Yahoo's fantasy football leagues and the lawsuit against the NFL. And then another story about Tony La Russa, who is a Major League Baseball manager, and he apparently sued Twitter. So why don't we start off with the software patent issues. So I'm going to direct some questions first to Dominic. Can you tell me a little bit about software patents and the types of IP protection that applies to software?
Well, I guess first, sort of the case you're referencing, Bilski, isn't per se about software patents. The Bilski case was handed down by the Federal Circuit, which is the court of appeals that has exclusive jurisdiction over all patents. And basically that it isn't so much a software patent case as it is a business methods case. And sort of to provide a little introduction to what business methods are, as you might imagine, they're a method of doing business. And beyond that, it's not exactly clear what the Federal Circuit thinks they are. The decision sort of tried to eliminate pure business method patents that aren't tied to a specific machine or that don't transform anything in the real world. This impacts software because software could be construed to be nothing more than a series of instructions, some of which could be performed by machine, but don't necessarily have to be. The way software code works is that if I showed you code and you wanted to perform everything mentally by hand and you had a lot of time and were very patient, you could theoretically do that. So the Bilski decision, the Supreme Court has granted cert on that, which means they're going to review it and take a look at it, and it'll be very interesting to see what the justices will rule. This is probably the most important patent case in the last 50 years.
So why is that? What has been going on in the whole software and patent area in the last 30 or so years?
Why is what, sorry?
Well, there's been a lot of discussion about whether software should even merit a patent in the end of the day. I mean, are there other types of IP protection that might already apply?
All right. Well, software, when it started out 20 or 30 years ago, originally it wasn't clear what sort of IP protection software would get. It ended up with patent protection for software that's tied to a particular machine or the business method patent route, which is now in doubt because of Bilski, and also copyright protection. Software is considered a written work in a tangible fixed medium, so the code that someone writes is subject to copyright protection. But because software so often imbues ideas that can be expressed in multiple ways, in multiple different ways, the copyright protection may only seems to protect the particular expression of that software and doesn't necessarily protect the idea behind that, which you can't protect with copyright law. Patent law, you can't protect ideas, but you can protect inventions. And the question that the court is going to be considering is where or what is the limits of the invention when something isn't tied to a particular machine, or even if it is, if something can be performed by humans without needing a machine, what are those limits as well?
So to clear something up, if you've got a piece of software that you wrote in, say, C++, and I rewrote that software in Python, you couldn't sue me for copyright infringement?
Well, it depends how you rewrote it. If you rewrote it so that it would be a derivative work, you could get sued for copyright infringement. But if you reverse engineered it, say that you had someone analyze the code, write up specs, and then you, without looking at the code originally and just based off those specs, rewrote it, then it would be very unlikely you would be sued for copyright infringement because you weren't looking at the copyrighted material. You were just trying to extract the ideas out of it.
Okay.
It's so, just to draw an analogy, I guess, suppose that you wrote a murder mystery where someone kills someone else, and then I summarized this murder mystery but changed all the names and then gave it to Dave, and Dave wrote a different murder mystery using the same sort of idea, that wouldn't be copyright infringement of the first murder mystery because it's extracted the sort of generalized idea out of it.
So copyright doesn't protect ideas, but patent can protect ideas.
Patent protects inventions, and inventions can embody ideas.
Well, it's important to point out that copyright doesn't actually protect functional elements also. As we already mentioned, it protects the expression of those elements. So do you guys think it's fair to say that patent law, at least to some extent, sort of fills in some of the gaps when it comes to the unique nature of software that copyright protection might not afford to it?
I think that would be accurate to say. I think that,
you know,
these people put a lot of time into developing software and, you know, specific algorithms for this software, and they deserve some sort of protection. The question is, what kind of protection and how long does it last? Because in the software industry, 20 years is a long time. And if we think about it, the first Mac OS is just a little over 20 years old, and there's very little in that first OS that's still useful, that still would have deserved any patent protection even 5 or 6 years ago.
Now, what about patent trolls and some of the other concerns that commentators have on software protection? I mean, it's certainly been said that a lot of people, or a lot of companies and people, are protecting trivial portions of software, basically, and they're holding them and waiting to spring them on the unsuspecting moments, and they're using some of the nuanced areas of patent law, one of which is the doctrine of equivalence, which basically says that even though you have a patent, it says that you have something that's protected under there. There are sometimes some areas where even though you haven't exactly copied something as it might appear in the wording of a patent application or a patent itself, that it still might be infringement. So how do the patent trolls play into this whole argument, and what are you guys' thoughts on them?
Well, I guess it might help to clarify what you mean by patent troll.
Well, patent troll are basically, there's a lot of different ways that they can kind of pop up. One of the more common ways is sort of a company that has aggregated sometimes one or several patents, and they sort of hold them, because remember that patents basically give the patent holder or the patent owner a monopoly on the invention that's claimed. And they hold them and wait for perhaps the correct moment, or they wait for another company or another person to invent something that's either pretty similar or almost identically similar to what's in the patent, and then they spring a lawsuit on them. And, you know, there's a bunch of things they could try to get out of that, too.
All right. Patents, technically, I guess, don't grant a monopoly on something. They more grant a right to exclude, which can create a monopoly, but doesn't necessarily. But so with the question of patent trolls, I guess, first, is their patent valid? That's presumed valid because it's an issued patent issued by the patent office. But basically, a lot of the patents that patent trolls, I guess, have been accused of holding have been business method patents, which are the ones that are now kind of in doubt because of Bilski's holding, which tried to get rid of pure business method patents without actually saying what they are, explicitly delineating the bounds of what a business method patent is, which means that software patents may or may not be business method patents. So in that regard, patent trolls, no one apart from the patent trolls, it seems, likes patent trolls too much. But it's important to say, to distinguish, that not every patent holding company is a patent troll. There are some valid inventing companies out there who have valid patents and do have the right to protect their interests, and they're not patent trolls in that regard. I guess the more narrow definition of a patent troll would be someone who's actually a patent lawyer and goes and gets patents and then just tries to make a living out of suing people off of the patents that he or she has acquired.
That's probably a little bit more accurate. Ben, do you have any thoughts?
Well, I think we need to define kind of what the current scope... We talked about this a little bit, what the current scope of what can be protected by a patent is, before we can determine whether or not how the Supreme Court is going to rule in this case. If we go back to a case a few years ago now called Diamond v. Chakrabarty, the court said that anything under the sun made by man is patentable. In that case, Chakrabarty worked for, I think it was General Electric, and he made a bacterium that could digest oil from oil spills. and people, the patent office challenged the patent on the grounds that you can't patent something that's living, something that's living life, and the Supreme Court said that's absurd. You know, this inventor took a bacterium that existed and took these other genes, and he made a new, totally unique life form that has some sort of utility, and this is an important thing, and it's useful, and the inventor deserves the rights over that. So if that's the case, why isn't an algorithm, which is something that's made by man under the sun, made by man or woman under the sun, why isn't that patentable, or why shouldn't that be patentable? And Dominic touched on this a little earlier, but one of the tenets of patent law is that you cannot patent something that already existed in nature or is a law of nature. So you can't patent a mathematical formula. And when you think about it, one argument is that all a software algorithm is a mathematical formula. It's a series of instructions. It's a series of computations. So it's something that, like Dominic said, you could do in your head. So why can you get a patent protection over that, or why couldn't you? So what are the two solutions, what are the two exceptions to that, that the Federal Circuit outlined in Bilski?
Are you referring to the machine or transformation test?
Yes.
Okay.
Basically, the Federal Circuit said that as long as this method, because first, I guess the important distinction to make between Chakrabarty and this is Chakrabarty dealt with invention, a thing, not a method, not a process. And here in Bilski, we're dealing with business method patents, which are process patents. So they're not technically under the sun because they're just a way of doing something. They might result in something that ends up under the sun, so to speak, but they themselves are just a process. The machine or transformation test basically says that this process has to be tied to a particular machine or has to involve a transformation of something in the real world. Basically, that means that you can't just say, oh, I'm transforming something in my head. That doesn't count. It has to be something that makes a difference in the real world.
Now, how does that apply in the real world, though? Do you guys have any experience with any of this?
My impression was that the particular machine requirement only goes so far as to say you can't say that this, you know, this method has to be performed on a computer. It has to be a specific type of computer. I've heard it suggested that that could be as narrow, or rather as broad as a multiple-cored PC, which at this point makes up a significant portion of the PCs on the market today. I know most of the MacBooks have dual cores. All of the desktop Macs have dual cores. Other than netbooks, I think most consumer machines have multiple cores. So if that's the case, if narrowing this to only multiple-cored machines is sufficient to get around this Bilski restriction, then it doesn't have much of an effect in the real world.
So basically, after years of some acceptance, or at least a lot of acceptance of software patents, the Federal Circuit has sort of come out in the last couple of years and changed their view entirely and said, we need to restrict what is out there. And they tied it into this test that we're now referring to as the machine or transformation test. And it has caused a lot of controversy because I think it produced uncertainty also. People weren't really sure what was then going to be accepted by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office as a patentable subject matter or something, some sort of invention that could be patented. But now we have it going before the Supreme Court, and do you guys have any predictions on what the Supreme Court might do or what they're going to be looking at in particular?
I'm just going to nitpick one more time and just say that this is about business method patents and not necessarily software patents. I know it's very tempting to draw conclusions and say, oh, what will happen to software patents? But the actual Bilski case itself doesn't involve any technology at all. It's just a method of hedging risk and commodity trading. So there's, in the actual claims of the patent, there's nothing about any software, there's nothing about any machine, there's nothing about any sort of technology at all. It's just a method of hedging risk involving commodity trading. It's basically a set of steps. Do this, do this, do this. Find this, and then you'll hedge your risk. So I guess that's sort of just a caveat that Bilski only deals with business method patents, and any implications with software patents are just that, implications.
They're ancillary, basically, to the issue of business method patents, because as we look at this in terms of precedent value, it's going to apply in sort of the umbrella sense into the software patent area, but that's a very valid distinction you're drawing there.
You go, Dominic.
No, it's fine.
My feeling as to how the Supreme Court is going to rule is similar to how they've ruled in the past cases on appeals from the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, in which the Supreme Court looks at the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office and goes, you guys were interpreting this in a very narrow way. And they've looked at the Federal Circuit recently and said the same thing. You have been interpreting our rules very narrowly, and we want to grant broad patent protections. So my feeling is that they will say that you can get business patent methods over a larger swath of things than the Federal Circuit thinks.
Dominic?
I'm probably actually going to disagree with that prediction. I'm going to say that looking at some of the oral arguments that Justice Roberts and Justice Scalia have had with people in other cases that have come before the Supreme Court, I'm going to predict that the Supreme Court's going to make a rather narrow holding on business method patents and try to stay within the bounds of just the Bilski decision and not go too much beyond that. So we probably won't have software patents resolved out of this decision, and we'll have business method patents probably overruling the Federal Circuit slightly, but not anything back to the great breadth that we had in the before Bilski was handed down. So I'm going to sort of say that the Supreme Court's going to come up with something narrow and very careful and only a slight expansion over Bilski without going back to the pre-Bilski sort of open season.
I don't want to open this up to major political discussion, but you know, as everyone's probably following in the media a little bit, we're looking at a potentially new nomination with Justice Sotomayor on the Supreme Court. And do you guys have any thoughts about any relevant policy issues that you might have seen in some of her decisions that she's printed since she's been on the Second Circuit, and how that might affect the area of either patent law or other types of technology law related to it?
I know she has a background in cyber law, which I think is good just to have judges who are more familiar with cyber law, but that was bound to happen as the older justices retired anyway. As for specifically patent law, because she sits on the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which is New York, Vermont, and Connecticut, I want to say, she hasn't heard any patent cases since she was elevated to the appeals court, and I'm not familiar with any patent decisions that she handed down when she was in the Federal Circuit for New York in the Southern District.
So it's pretty unclear about how she might potentially rule on this in terms of policy.
Timing-wise, she wouldn't participate in Bilski, right? That would happen before...
I believe that's correct, as far as I know.
Bilski's going to be her next term. She's going to confirmed sometime over the summer. And then she'll be sitting starting in the fall, and she'll hear Bilski arguments. Supreme Court has finished hearing arguments for this year.
Okay.
Oh, that's actually an important point right there. Okay, well, so Bilski is by far an extremely important case in terms of business method patents, and more specifically as that might apply in the broad sense to patentable subject matter and software, of course. So we'll have to keep our eyes open. I'm sure that there'll be plenty of stories coming out in the coming months about the way that the Bilski decision might be decided before the court. So moving on, we have another interesting story here. Recently, this week, there was a couple of news postings that Yahoo has sued the NFL, in particular for usage of certain types of facts, photos, and images under their fantasy football program. So do any of you guys, have you had any experience with fantasy football or any of the fantasy sports on Yahoo?
I have not, but it's important to note that Yahoo isn't suing the NFL per se. They're suing the NFL Players Association, which is a group that represents the players and controls the players' interests in their names, their likenesses, pictures, and the deals that they make with the NFL and other organizations.
It's still at issue is the statistics that come out from the players as they play in the NFL.
It might be good to sort of preface this whole discussion with a procedural note, because it may seem odd that, wait a second, Yahoo is suing the NFL Players Association?
Right, right.
It's another one of those cases where Yahoo is suing to prevent being sued. It's because the NFL Players Association, from what I understand, they said that they were going to sue Yahoo, and Yahoo decided to sue first in order to preempt that lawsuit and get it in the venue in the court that they wanted. Is that accurate?
That's absolutely accurate. But before we go there, let's just back up and
okay.
if we could hash out what exactly how the fantasy sports work under Yahoo. And my understanding is, and it's been several years, maybe even more than that, since my last time I've ever fooled around with any of the fantasy sports. But basically, it allows users to go onto the website and you sign up for sort of like you create your own team and you're able to draft players and you play in sort of either a tight group. They're pretty popular, and you can manage your team as the season goes along. And using the statistics that come out with from the NFL as it's actually playing, you sort of accumulate points based on the players that you have on your team, you know, the team that you have created, and it sort of becomes a bit of a competition online. So now we can sort of dive in a little bit to this lawsuit. The technical term that's used is a declaratory judgment, and what happened in the case so far is that Yahoo, over the last several years, had a license agreement with the Players Association body to be able to use certain photos, images, actual signatures from some of the players, and, of course, statistics on their website. And sort of recently, about a year or two ago, actually it might even be 3 years ago now, under the Major League Baseball, And you got to remember that Yahoo has fantasy sports teams across all of the major sports in the U.S. The Major League Baseball fantasy program had a similar issue that popped up, and there was another lawsuit involving the usage of those types of statistics, and Yahoo basically came out winning that lawsuit. And the court, in very short summary, said that it was permissible for Yahoo to use those types of statistics. So what's really at issue here in the lawsuit, Ben?
Well, just to clear something up, I'm pretty sure that wasn't the MLB lawsuit wasn't Yahoo. That was another company called CBC Corporation or CBC Holdings.
CBC Distribution and Marketing.
Yes, yeah. That's it. So it wasn't Yahoo, but essentially what's at issue is that Yahoo... No one... in my view, is contesting that you can't use the statistics. The statistics are fact. They're unprotectable by copyright law. You can't protect facts. What Yahoo is doing is saying Yahoo wants to use the players' faces, the players' names, the players' numbers, biographical information about the players in conjunction with their fantasy football. And the NFL Players Association claims to have rights over those things, claims to, you know, be the sole place where you can get the right to use players' names, likenesses, numbers, signatures, biographical information.
So in order to use that information, they want to be paid, is what you're saying?
Yes. Yes, they do. And Yahoo doesn't think that they should have to pay to use this publicly available information about the players.
So is this a copyright case at all, or you think this is a pure... publicity case?
I think it's a pure publicity case. I read
meaning the right to publicity specifically.
Yes, the right of the players to control how their likenesses, how their faces and names are used in commerce.
So what is that right, if you could describe it, and where do we find that in the law?
So it's a state right, largely. There are some federal rights that are ancillary to this, but it's defined on a state-by-state basis, and essentially it says... The general definition is that if you have a non-consensual a use of somebody's name or likeness that identifies that person without their consent and it's for commercial gain, then you violated this person's right to publicity. A prime example would be something like if I were to make Wheaties and I put Dale Earnhardt Jr. on the front of my Wheaties box without consent from Dale Earnhardt Jr., he would have a violation of his right of publicity. He should be able to make money off of having his face on my Wheaties box. And if I don't pay him, or if I'm not getting consent from him, then I'm violating that right to publicity.
Okay. So I think that's a pretty good explanation of it. So, in the case specifically here, though, is if we read the complaint, and of course the complaint will be a link to the complaint will be posted in the show notes. They've also asked that they be able to use certain photographs. What do you think about that? Still publicity?
I think it is to some degree. I'm like I said in my Wheaties example, you have to use the photograph of them. is your question whether or not it's within Yahoo's First Amendment right to use that, or whether or not that's still in place? Oh, I see what your question is. Your question is whether or not copying somebody's photo also results in a copyright claim.
Correct.
My guess is Yahoo would use photos that they have that aren't made by the NFL Players Association. It's easy enough to get a photo of a person, to get a licensed photo of someone.
So it's a little unclear based on the complaint itself, but if you look at the complaint under the introduction and then paragraph 3, it clearly lists photographs as one of the things that they would like to use. And it would seem, though, that if there were photographs that Yahoo owned, that there wouldn't really be any dispute as to the legal disposition of those photographs for whether or not that they could use them. But nonetheless, it seems to be listed in the complaint. We don't have enough facts, I guess, in the end of the day.
I guess my understanding of Yahoo's sort of argument is they're looking at the two cases that have been decided with regard to fantasy sports online beforehand.
Right.
Like Ben mentioned, the CBC distribution marketing one, and then the Major League Baseball. And then there was also a CBS Interactive case against the NFL Players Association, which came down, I think, this past April. And Yahoo's, the gem of what I understand of Yahoo's argument is that they're basically saying, look, this is fantasy football, this is fantasy sports stuff, this information is public for the purposes of fantasy sports information, thus it can't be protected by copyright law, and that trumps any right of publicity because it's being used in a fantasy sports environment, which those two cases have both come out and said that you can't try to protect that sort of information in a fantasy sports environment. I don't know whether photographs were in play at those two, but statistics certainly, and their names certainly. And if Yahoo's using photographs that it owns and it's paid for, then it isn't really infringing on the player's right of publicity because those photographs have already been appropriately licensed.
Right. In the CBC decision, I went through that and I didn't see any mention of actual photographs being used. So, you know, the whole purpose of me sort of drawing this out is sort of curious as to whether certain elements that are brought in this Yahoo case make it factually different from any of the CBC cases. Maybe just with respect to the inclusion of photographs or not. I don't know. That's a good question. But certainly, actually, in the other cases, first of all, it should be important to note that the players' associations in the MLB case, and I'm not sure if it was the CBS case too, have indicated that they want to appeal the decision. So the actual disposition is of the suit is sort of a little bit unknown still too. So maybe that explains why that the NFL Players Association didn't want to sort of acknowledge these prior decisions that came down, and they were willing to take it to litigation. Do you guys think that there's any actual merit to the Players Association arguments?
I don't think that they have a particular load of merit. And in fact, Yahoo's bringing two arguments, and these two arguments were also brought up in the CBC Holdings case, which is essentially, first, that the First Amendment rights of Yahoo to use this publicly available information trumps the player's right of publicity. And secondly, the federal copyright law extends certain bounds over what you can and cannot protect, and that you can't have these state laws come in and protect something that copyright law would not ordinarily grant protection over.
Right. So I think actually the relevant section that we're talking about is Section 301 of the Copyright Act, and it prohibits states basically from granting protection to certain subject matter that falls within the domain of the Copyright Act. And prescribing exclusions that are similar to those that would be granted under the Copyright Act.
Right.
It has very specific wording, too, and I don't think, at least in the CBC decision, they really discussed very much some of the tests that might be applied to that. Whether or not they're relevant, I mean, that might not even matter. There are a couple tests that courts use to look at these things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they did not look at that closely, at least in the appeal of the CBC decision. We do see, however, that state law does get preempted in issues of intellectual property law. The two things that pop into my mind immediately are in the area of trademark and patent law. Florida at one point passed a law saying that you can't copy the hull of a ship, what companies used to do is you'd have a company that spent a lot of time and money developing the hull of a ship. They would release that that to the market, and a copycat company would come in, basically make a cast of that hull and reproduce the hull of that ship and sell it on the secondary market as a knockoff. Florida tried to come in and prevent that from happening, and the courts found that that type of law was preempted, that you couldn't issue protection over something that there's already federal protection of, or that federal law specifically prevents the protection of.
So as I think you mentioned before, Ben, the Copyright Act, there are very particular things that under the Copyright Act are essentially dedicated to the public domain, and that what that really means is that they're essentially not protected by copyright law. And to the extent of the stuff that's at issue in this case, when we talk about the facts, statistics, player names, the numbers that they use while they're playing, those essentially would not be protected under the Copyright Act. And so, therefore, because of that, because we have this provision in the Copyright Act, trying to enforce that under a state law, like a law of publicity, wouldn't work in a court.
Right, that's the essential argument. And I personally think that it's the winning argument, that Yahoo's going to win this case. And frankly, this isn't the type of thing that you really want to protect with publicity law. You want to protect the Wheaties box. You don't want to protect using publicly available information, because if we're trying to clamp down on the use of publicly available information, it's an impossible line to draw.
Well, at the same time, though, isn't Yahoo making money from this whole transaction in the end? I mean, they're selling ads based on users coming onto the Yahoo site, and those users are then using the Yahoo services and seeing those ads, possibly clicking on them, and so then you have sort of a commercial aspect to the usage of these things. Does that affect any of that?
It is certainly an element. The commercial use and making some sort of commercial profit on this is definitely an element of the misappropriation, the right of publicity, but it's not like when I, again, going to the Wheaties example. I love Wheaties. When you go to the market, you buy Wheaties because of this endorsement. It's not like anyone is confusing the players. It's not like anyone is thinking that the players are endorsing the Yahoo system, the Yahoo Fantasy Football season system. It's just that Yahoo needs a way to explain what players you're using, and they can't do that without using the players' names, and it helps if you also have the players' images.
So it seems like, as the law stands today, it's an attenuated argument by the Players Association. Dominic, do you have anything to add?
I guess my final point is that if the NFL Players Association really wants to make money off of fantasy football, then they should just start their own fantasy football site, get it advertised with the NFL. I'm sure they would, just because they'd be like, we're the official fantasy football site of the NFL, people would gladly use theirs.
Right. All right, well, I think we have sort of hashed out what's going on there. And finally, we come to our last interesting story that popped up this week. Tony La Russa, who is a major league manager for the St. Louis Cardinals, has sued Twitter. And he sued Twitter because someone created a fake profile on the site and started making posts, tweets, that sort of involved him. And there was a picture of him on the site. And he sued Twitter, and it later came out, actually, that the lawsuit was settled. So in the complaint, which is, of course, the document that gets filed in the court that specifies what the lawsuit is about, Tony La Russa and his lawyers alleged various trademark claims and misappropriation of likeness claims. Do one of you guys want to explain that?
How about you can, Dave?
Well, essentially, Tony La Russa, over the last, he's been a major league manager, I think, for several decades now. And what he basically says in the complaint is that the use of his name and likeness has become sufficiently distinct under trademark law, meaning that it can be recognized by consumers and stuff. He also has several other websites, including, I think, TonyLaRussa.com. In the Bay Area, he founded the Animal Rescue Foundation, also known as ARF, and a lot of his websites redirect to there. And basically, there was a few things looking at the Twitter page. If everyone who's listening is familiar with Twitter, you should know what it looks like. But, you know, you get a little slogan that says, and you fill in the username, so-and-so is using Twitter. In this case, it said Tony La Russa is using Twitter. And his argument was is that it appeared that he was endorsing the usage or this profile on the page. And more specifically, what had been tweeted was even more interesting. So over the years, Tony La Russa had been involved in, or he was being part of the St. Louis Cardinals. There was two incidents where two of his pitchers died, one of which died from a heart condition, I think, in a hotel in Chicago, and another died in an automobile accident, and it was later determined that the pitcher in question had a blood alcohol content that was over the legal limit. And I guess recently, too, either in the last couple of weeks or so, a news story popped up that La Russa himself was arrested for DUI because he was found in his car, which was running at the time, and he was asleep behind the wheel. I think it was parked, but he was arrested for driving under the influence because that sort of applies in state laws there. So this one tweet basically said to the extent that, I got out of Chicago and no pitchers had died, and you know I was able to drive drunk the whole way or something to that extent. So there was some question of whether or not that might have been intended to inflict emotional distress over La Russa. So there, you know, there were some sort of parody aspects to this. At the same time, clearly the page and the profile itself were poking fun at La Russa, and it turned into a trademark claim basically because of the usage of his name in the profile.
Right. What's asserted isn't that Twitter, the corporation in any way, tried to cause emotional distress to Mr. La Russa. It was that through the use of the website, somebody had gone onto Twitter and misappropriated Mr. La Russa's name as a trademark. And various other trademark-related claims like dilution of Tony La Russa's name as a trademark, as an identifier of himself and of what he does. So
over the last couple of years, Twitter has become, you know, fairly popular now, and it's been totally commonplace to see these fake profiles pop up of famous personalities and stuff. And now this seems to be at least the first case, to my knowledge, a lawsuit that was filed against Twitter specifically. There's been other websites that have been sued for fake profiles being created, but this is certainly the first one. So how does this work in the end of the day? We have three parties involved in this. We have Tony La Russa, and we have Twitter, the website, and the company, essentially. And then we have this guy who we don't know that created the profile on Twitter. How does the liability work out in here, and how does Tony La Russa have a claim against Twitter in the end of the day when somebody else has created the created the profile on the website?
I'm going to go out on a limb and say that Tony La Russa does not have a very good claim against Twitter, the corporation. And that's because of something that's our very good friend and ally, the CDA, Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which essentially says that a provider of online interactive services shall not be held liable as a speaker for anything that a user posts on their website.
Well, that's actually, it's not for copyright law, but it doesn't protect intellectual property claims, right?
I'm pretty sure that's a subsection of the Copyright Act, isn't it?
The CDA? No, the CDA is a standalone section under the U.S. Code. I think it's 47 U.S.C. 230.
Yes.
It specifically excludes, I think the language goes something to the extent, you know, notwithstanding intellectual property law. So
okay.
That would protect other types of liability aspects for organizations that qualify under the CDA. We had a discussion last week, by the way, listeners, about the CDA, and there's a pretty good explanation of that in there if you want to listen to that. So anyways, but this is interesting, though. So, I mean, La Russa has trademark claims then against Twitter, and so Twitter may not then qualify for any type of immunity under the CDA. Are there any other policy considerations of why Twitter should not be held liable? I mean, Twitter really didn't do very much here. They didn't create this profile. They weren't the wrongdoers in this. It's some other guy.
Right. So one of the claims that Tony La Russa makes is going very specifically here is something under what's called the Anti-Cyber Squatting and Consumer Protection Act. And that only protects people who do cyber squatting. It protects specifically domain names. And domain names are defined as anything that was registered with a domain registrar. So Tony La Russa is trying to make the argument that twitter.com/Tony La Russa is a domain name, which very clearly under the Trademark Act, it is not. So that claim, in my view, is meritless.
But is there any merit to the fact that Twitter has somehow contributed or caused any type of trademark confusion by allowing this profile to simply exist? I mean, the other thing that's sort of factually significant is that this account didn't appear to be very, very used at all. There was only a couple of tweets that were posted on the profile itself.
Right. I'm still going back to the CDA. So to read the language, this is 47 U.S.C. 230 subsection E subsection 2. Nothing in this section shall be construed to limit or expand any law pertaining to intellectual property.
Correct.
I really have no idea what that means, though.
Well, it seems to say, and this is my reading of it, is that the CDA does not give any immunity to online service providers for intellectual property matters. Those are exclusively covered by the Copyright Act and also the Patent Act and, of course, the Lanham Act, which is the act that has all the trademark provisions in it.
Yeah, and the Anti-Cyber Squatting Consumer Protection Act, specifically that part of it, is part of the Lanham Act.
Correct. So it seems that they don't, for at least for the intellectual property claims, which include the trademark stuff and the Anti-Cyber Squatting Protection Act, those do not qualify for that type of immunity. However, the other types of liability claims, which include the misappropriation of likeness, might fall under the CDA. Is that a good understanding of that?
It may, but it's hard to tell what kind of liability Twitter would have, considering they were a completely passive participant in this.
I think it's unclear too, and you know what, the complaint doesn't really pan out very well why Twitter should actually be liable for this, and you know I do not have a good explanation. And as we mentioned in the first part of this, there are some news accounts that have said that Twitter settled. They actually settled apparently before this weekend, but now that might actually be called into question according to Dominic. Is that right, Dominic?
Yeah, it looks like they didn't settle, and instead Twitter posted, I think, that they have not settled. We'll include this in our podcast notes. And they're actually going to launch verified accounts over the summer so that you can, there'll be a little special seal that says that this is a verified account, that this is the real account for this famous person or this government agency. But the word from Twitter's own blog is reports this week that Twitter has settled a lawsuit and officially agreed to pay legal fees for an impersonation complaint that was taken care of by our support staff in accordance with our terms are erroneous. Twitter has not settled, nor do we plan to settle or pay. And I guess the thing that is worth noting with this case is they actually did, as soon as Tony La Russa filed this complaint, they killed the account and took it down because it did violate the terms of service of Twitter.
Mm-hmm. So maybe this clarifies some of our confusion on, you know, why there might have been some sort of news report out there that Twitter had settled. But in the end of the day, the other thing that I was trying to get at is that there are still limitations on what you can claim under the trademark law, and the First Amendment certainly applies to that. And regardless of whether you're trying to hold Twitter or the individual user who created the account liable for a trademark claim, the First Amendment sort of acts as a balancing mechanism, and it limits it. You know, you can't just have these lawsuits all over the place that claim trademark infringement when it's kind of, you got this gray area of a parody. And under the little biography or the bio section that appears on the Twitter page, I think there was even some language there which indicated that the profile was
Bio parodies are fun for everyone, which, I mean, it's even in the screenshot in the complaint that they filed. It's pretty clear that it's a parody.
So it seems that most regular users know that these fake accounts get created all over the place, and you know they're sort of funny, and some of them are short-lived, and some of them go on for a little while before they get killed. And you know, now it's turned into lawsuits. Do we think that we can see more lawsuits now, or?
Well, people like to sue people, and I mean, there's not that many fake accounts out there. The vast majority of accounts are actually legit on Twitter. And I mean, as for whether more or less lawsuits, or more or fewer lawsuits, as long as they can, eventually, I think it'll peter down. It depends how Twitter decides to handle this. I think verified accounts are going to be a step in the right direction. And Twitter has been doing a really good job in terms of taking down fake accounts whenever they get reported. Again, I have to agree with Ben that I just don't see what liability Twitter has for if they take an account down. I mean, just the fact that someone made a fake account on Twitter, well, that's not Twitter's fault.
Right, right. And I, you know what, I absolutely agree with that assertion too. I mean, it's pretty clear that the wrongdoer here is whoever it was that created this account, and it wasn't Twitter, and there was no, as far as we know, according to the facts, I mean, it might very well come out at some point in the future that the person who actually created the account was an employee at Twitter, however unlikely that might be. But at the same time, you know, a lawsuit against Twitter alleging damages seems attenuated in the end. And I don't think in any sense that these are the types of lawsuits, and you guys can chime in when you like, that these are the types of lawsuits that we'll continue to see in the future. At least they won't be successful, they might be filed, but there are very clear provisions under the law which protect entities like Twitter and other online service provider websites which allow third parties, users, to post content on them. So it's an interesting lawsuit, but at the same time, I don't think that it has a lot of merit to it. Do you guys have any final thoughts?
No, I think you summed it up nicely.
Good job.
Okay, all right. Well, I think we're going to wrap it up there. Like I said in the beginning, look out for our website at technicallylegal.org. We're going to be going live, and by that we mean that we're going to start having a lot more posts covering a lot of different stories, including many that we don't get to cover in our podcast. We welcome feedback on the podcast, so please visit our website, and you can find information there on how to contact us, and we welcome input, criticism, and any kind of commentary you might have on the website, and also things that you might want to see us cover in the future. So thank you very much for tuning in today. I'm David O'Brien, and with me today,
Dominic Rabier
and Ben Snitkoff. Thanks for listening. If you have any comments, email us at podcast@technicallylegal.org.
Have a great one.